Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 121, Psychopathology in the Workplace, December 1st, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
We know from our everyday experience that people are not the same. People have differences in personalities. Some of these are simply harmless, colorful quirks that people have. Others are much more serious. But everybody's different in some way. And I like to think of personality and psychopathology as kind of the new diversity that workplaces have to account for. I mean, we've become good at getting sensitive to cultural diversity, to ethnic diversity, but what we've missed is the fact that people within any given cultural, ethnic, religious, or socioeconomic group are going to have wide variations. And unless you know how to recognize what makes these people tick and know how to deal with it, then you're going to have difficulty with the people you work with.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Lawrence Miller. Lawrence Miller, PhD, is a clinical and forensic psychologist, educator, author, speaker, and management consultant. He is author of 6 books, the most recent being From Difficult to Disturbed, Understanding and Managing Dysfunctional Employees. He maintains a private practice in psychology and also works extensively with law enforcement, the judicial system, social service agencies, and private corporations. Dr. Miller lives and works in Boca Raton, Florida. Longtime listeners may recall Shrink Wrap Radio number 40, in which I interviewed Dr. Miller on practical police psychology. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Lawrence Miller, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be back on the show.
Well, it's been about a year since I interviewed you on your book on practical police psychology, and now you've got another one out already.
I'm usually always working on something, so I've either got something in the oven or coming out.
Well, good for you. And this time, you've written a book about psychopathology in the workplace, which is a subject that I think everyone can probably relate to. What were the challenges of writing this book?
It actually wasn't that much of a challenge because I was really kind of systematically addressing something that's obvious to most people who work in any kind of environment, whether it's a shop floor or an office setting. And in fact, unlike the police psychology book, which was kind of a specialized audience, the reaction I've gotten to this book of people who've read it is, how did you know that this is the guy I work with or this is the girl I supervise? And because what I'm really doing is kind of explaining the everyday different varieties of human nature that people encounter in the workplace. And people relate to this very strongly because it affects their lives on a day-to-day basis. You know, we spend a third of our existence, or at least our adult existence, at work. And a workplace really is kind of a second family. It's almost a tribal culture that we have away from our family and home life. And the kinds of dynamics and rivalries and allegiances and politics that go on at work are just as strong as those that go on within one's family, oftentimes. And it's important to understand how to deal with people there as well as at home.
Yeah, well, you know, I think over the years, people have asked me for a resource for dealing with difficult people at work. Now, as you sat down to write this book, who, in fact, was your intended audience? Who did you have in mind?
Well, this book, unlike the previous book, which is more of a specialized textbook, From Difficult to Disturbed, is really a manual for the online manager who has to sort of hit the ground running with dealing with a variety of different types of workers. But I was also very careful to include a section in each chapter for employees who have to deal with managers, because sometimes the only way to really get along at work is to know how to manage those who manage you. And that's why each chapter has a section dealing with how to deal with an employee who reports to you if you are a manager. But also, every manager has to report to somebody. So there are sections in there on how to deal with your boss as well. And finally, there's a section in the back of each chapter that helps the reader get a little bit of self-insight, because a lot of times it's very easy to see the foibles and the problems of other people. What's much, much more difficult is to see them when they occur in ourselves. And so what I try to do is give readers who are having difficulty at work some tips that will help them stop tripping over their own feet and standing in their own way, recognize the patterns that they may be having at work, and some tips for overcoming those patterns for being maximally successful.
Well, those all seem like really important bases to have covered. And you're right, it may be not the employee who's disturbed, but sometimes it is the manager, and then that can really be a challenge to deal with. Now, you said that this book, you know, wasn't too challenging for you to write, but it seems to me that you had an interesting task, in as much as I think you wanted to be faithful and accurate to the demands of clinical psychology on the one hand, but also to make the concepts, the diagnostic concepts and so on, accessible to non-psychologist managers and readers.
Well, you know, people who read business books know you can walk into the business section of any bookstore and there are rows and rows of books creaking under the weight of every manner of management guide. And the problem is they each have their own idiosyncratic little approach and idiosyncratic little program. And the problem is, no matter what the variation of the program is, most of these books, most of these guides, most of the training courses that managers take treat people as if they were all cookie-cutter replicants of one another. So there'll be a course on management that deals with, you know, managing young people or managing diversity or managing women or managing a certain kind of industry. But they'll assume that everybody in that category is the same. And we know from our everyday experience that people are not the same. People have differences in personalities. Some of these are simply harmless, colorful quirks that people have. Others are much more serious. But everybody's different in some way. And I like to think of personality and psychopathology as kind of the new diversity that workplaces have to account for. I mean, we've become good at getting sensitive to cultural diversity, to ethnic diversity, but what we've missed is the fact that people within any given cultural, ethnic, religious, or socioeconomic group are going to have wide variations. And unless you know how to recognize what makes these people tick and know how to deal with it, then you're going to have difficulty with the people you work with. The other challenge, I guess, if you could call it, was to make it clear that this approach does not imply that people are nothing more than walking syndromes. Because what I found is the more you understand the dynamics behind a person's personality, actually the more respect you have for them, not less, because it illustrates that people really are complex. I used the standard mental health diagnostic categories, not so that managers could become diagnosticians, not so that managers think they have to become doctors or psychologists in order to manage well, but simply to provide some framework that's universally accepted by professionals in the field. I wanted a business manager to be able to pick this book up, ignore the diagnostic labels if they have to, and hit the ground running with some of the management strategies that are on almost every page. At the same time, I wanted a mental health professional to pick this book up and say, this is something that I can use in my consultation work. This is something I can use for teaching purposes. So I really tried, and hopefully successfully, to make a kind of crossover book that's going to be useful both to professionals, because it does use their lingo, so to speak, but also to everyday managers who don't have to be professional psychologists in order to manage well.
Well, that's one of the things I really like about your book is how effectively you straddle these two worlds of professional psychology on the one hand and the layperson on the other. The typical diagnostic categories of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual that people in mental health use, they tend to have a negative, disparaging quality to them. And one of the things I appreciate about your book is that you talk about all of these people in a very respectful way. They may have certain limitations or present certain challenges, but you also emphasize their potential to be productive workers and colleagues.
Well, you know, you make a very interesting point that I often point out when I give seminars on this topic. If you look at the labels of the different diagnostic categories, I mean, there are labels that are sort of historical labels like major depressive disorder or schizophrenia. But when you go into the section that deals with personality disorders, virtually every one of those disorders has some kind of disparaging name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if you go to a doctor and you have a diagnosis on your insurance form that says depression or even psychosis. I mean, you wouldn't want that to be anybody's business, but okay, this is a syndrome that people recognize. But how many people want to be called a borderline personality disorder? How many people want to be called a narcissistic personality? How many people want to be called an antisocial personality or an avoidant personality or a dependent personality or a histrionic personality or even everybody's favorite, the obsessive compulsive personality, and on and on and on and on. And you know, you wonder, could psychiatrists not come up with a less disparaging way of referring to these people? But this is the uniform we have to play with, so this is the lingo we have to use. And what I try to do is, if I can't avoid using the labels, at least give three-dimensional, fleshed-out descriptions of these individuals so they're not just seen as abstract syndromes that people have to use and manipulate. You know, and the other point is, by using good management strategies, you're not manipulating people. I mean, the strategies I present in the book, they're not tricks. They're not ways of fooling or manipulating your employees into doing what you want. They're ways of showing sincere understanding and then working with these people on an individual basis. And what's amazing is, if you show that you understand a person in a non-patronizing, in a non-belittling kind of way, people will respond to you. They're going to want to do a good job for you because they know that you respect them. And if that's something that comes out of managers reading this book and employees reading this book, then I will have done my job, because there's, you know, God knows there's little enough respect for people at work as it is.
Yeah. Well, let's step through the diagnostic categories that you cover in your book. And I love the way that you both mentioned the traditional DSM category, but then you come up with a kind of non-jargon term for each. For example, you start off with avoidant and dependent employees, who you characterize as shrinkers and clingers. Go ahead and describe those for us.
Well, I'll do the syndrome first. Basically, the avoidant personality is the person that most people would describe as being overly shy. They really fear people. People are intimidating to them. They just get uncomfortable among other people. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to do. They don't know where to put their hands. They're just very skittish, shy types of people. And so they tend to avoid social situations. And they indeed shrink from situations that may be threatening and challenging. The dependent personality also, in a way, is intimidated by people, but in a slightly different way. This is the person who overly depends on the validation and approval and opinion and guidance of other people. And managers will say, this is the person who, no matter how many times I tell him or her to do a task, they always seem to ask for more and more guidance. Can't they ever do anything on their own? Do I always have to spoon-feed this information to this employee? And the reason they keep needing the spoon-feeding is because they're insecure. They're never quite sure if they've gotten it right. And so these are the people who cling, and they can be just as annoying as the people who avoid. Probably the only good thing about these two personalities is that they don't necessarily cause trouble in the workplace, unlike some of the other personality types in the book. But what you can do is provide a reassuring presence and a reassuring environment. If you can give gentle direction and build that direction up cumulatively, so that either the shrinker or the clinger develops a sense of mastery and competence at the job that they're doing, what happens is eventually they find their niche and they're able to do a good job that's going to be acceptable for their work role. And if they can't do it, if it's something that's just impossible for them to do, they're probably not going to go into that kind of job in the first place. They're not going to become salespeople where they have to interact with people on a daily basis. They're not going to become public speakers or motivational seminar leaders. But if all they really have to do is sit in a cubicle and enter data into a computer and occasionally answer a phone call, that's something they can learn to do well if you provide them with a certain amount of stability and maintenance.
Okay. You know, somehow avoidant and dependent, they almost sound like opposites. Are they grouped together in the DSM?
Well, they are actually opposite. And the difference is, the avoidant personality just wants people to stay away from them. The dependent person wants the approval. They crave the strokes. They're needy people. They need people to approve of them. The avoidant person could basically just spend the whole day alone, and it wouldn't bother them. The dependent person, although they are still intimidated by people, it's that element of neediness that distinguishes it from the avoidant.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another category that you discuss, which the DSM would characterize as histrionic and borderline personalities, and you refer to them in a much kinder way as emoters and reactors, which is much more understandable and down to earth. So how
I don't know if it's kinder, but I try at least to be somewhat more colloquial and clear, because you know, if you look at the term histrionic personality, histrionic really means theatrical.
Yeah,
it means the person who is basically always on; they're putting on a show.
Right.
And everybody listening to this program knows at least one person like that. This is the person that doesn't just walk into a room; they burst into a room. They command the room. They're happy. They're laughing. They're social butterflies. They flit over to one person, to the next person. They always seem to be having a good time, and the people around them tend to have a good time. But the problem is that when you work in a workplace, sometimes you have to cut the comedy and get down to business, and you really have to get serious and focus on a task from beginning to end. And what these individuals have a hard time doing is maintaining that sense of stick-to-itiveness on a task that isn't intrinsically exciting and stimulating. And so what happens is they'll make a brilliant sales presentation, they'll charm the room, but when they have to go and write up the paperwork, they'll fall to pieces. It'll be late. It'll be done sloppily. It'll be done forgetfully. And they really need someone to help them in the follow through. The borderline personality is a reactor because they react extremely strongly. There's no shades of gray. It's black and white. They either love you or they hate you.
Right.
Sometimes they'll love you one moment and they'll hate you the next moment. They also tend to have very, let's say, interesting lives. They're always in some kind of crisis. This is the person that people say, my God, there always seems to be something going on in this person's life. There's some kind of romantic entanglement or financial struggle or legal hassle. And this is because they're extremely emotionally reactive and they tend to overreact. And life is just a series of vicious cycles for these individuals. The interesting thing is, sometimes if they are good at what they do at work, and if their work is appreciated, the workplace can often be an island of stability for these individuals. It's one of these thank God it's Monday phenomenon where they'll get in more trouble and have more chaos over the weekend, and they're only too glad to go back to the office on Monday because there's a sense of predictability and stability and competence and mastery that they can adhere to and do well at.
So is your recommendation then basically to give them lots of reinforcement, positive reinforcement, recognition, support?
And direction, and also, particularly with a borderline personality, a manager or even a coworker for that matter has to be very careful about something called boundaries. That is, if you work with somebody for a long period of time and you get kind of friendly, you'll start telling little jokes with each other, you'll share little intimacies. I mean, these are the kinds of things that a close friendship is made of. The problem with a borderline is they're going to overinterpret this. They're going to overinterpret this as a level of closeness and intimacy that may not even exist. And I'm not even talking about romantic intimacy. I'm just saying in terms of regarding their employer as the one person they can trust, the one person they can depend on. The problem is that sooner or later, that employer is or that coworker is going to do something to disappoint the borderline personality. And then what you're going to see is a 180-degree switch. Now you're worse than dirt. Now they hate you. Now you can do no right. And what happens is these individuals go from relationship to relationship, whether it's personal relationships or work relationships, with a huge Santa Claus-like bag of injustices. I mean, these are classic injustice collectors, always sensitive to people betraying them or letting them down, and they tend to end up being very cynical and untrusting people.
Boy, that description fits so well. Somebody that I knew in my past who would get a job and immediately put their boss on a pedestal. This was the most wonderful person, and how fortunate they were to work for such a wonderful, inspiring person. And then at some point, something would happen that would cause that to flip, and suddenly this person who had been an angel is now a devil.
And I'll bet if you looked at the past history, you would find that this is there's been a long string of these same kind of flip-flop types of relationships.
Exactly. This person moved from job to job to job during the period that I knew them, and it was frightening to see these changes. And I felt that in our own relationship, which started off very positive, it made me apprehensive that at some point it was going to flip, which in fact it did.
You know, it's interesting because you see this in clinical treatment too. When I have a patient who comes in, and usually in the first or second session, I hear them say something like, oh, Dr. Miller, you're the only person who understands me. I don't know why all the other 256 therapists that I've been to didn't have the same insight that you did. The little hairs in the back of my neck go up because I know it's just a matter of time until the other shoe is going to drop. And not always, but very frequently, that typically happens. It may be the very next session, it may be several months down the road, but I'll do something or say something or not answer a phone call fast enough or not write a letter that they wanted for some legal purpose, or somehow I'll refuse to gratify some particular wish, and then that's it. I'm just like all the others. Why did they ever trust me? You can't trust these mental health people. You're all a bunch of crocks, and it'll be on to the next therapist who'll pretty much be in line for the same treatment.
Yeah.
So if they're treating their doctors that way, you can be sure they treat other people in their lives the same way, whether it's relationships or workmates.
Well, the borderline is such a challenging personality. What if your boss happens to be of that type?
The only thing you can really do with a borderline boss is to set boundaries and limits very firmly. When you're given a direction, make sure you clearly understand what that boss wants you to do, because this is the boss who will invoke the frustrating situation of you being told what to do. You go out there and you do it, and it may take a whole day to do it, or it may take a year to do it, and then you'll come back and they'll say, I didn't tell you to do that. And what happened in the meantime is that they kind of changed their notion of what the project is, but to their mind, what they think right now is the absolute truth, and what they thought yesterday or the day before has no meaning. And if you remind them, if you show them documentation, if you show them a signed statement where they told you exactly what to do in black and white, they'll say, oh, well, that's not what I meant.
Oh, boy.
And so that's the most maddening circumstance. So when you get a task, make sure you document it, and make sure that you know exactly what it is you're supposed to do. And even then, you're not immune from the blowback. The other thing is, and this is very hard to do, but try, strange as it sounds, not to take it personally. You're going to get screamed at, yelled at, mad at, whatever it is, by this individual when they're in a bad mood. And what's going to be the most maddening thing is you're going to go home saying, my God, I'm going to quit this job. This is it. This is the last straw. I'm coming in tomorrow to give my notice and clean out my desk. And you come in the next morning, and it's all smiles. And then when you have the sour look on your face, he or she will look at you and say, what's your problem?
Do you watch Entourage on HBO by any chance?
No, I haven't seen that show.
Okay.
In fact, I just started watching The Office because I get calls and emails telling me that, did I base my book on that show?
Uh-huh. That's great.
And so now I'm watching the show. And, I mean, you know, the thing about that particular kind of TV show is the people on that show are, in a way, caricatures. I mean, they're really not real people. I mean, you know, to keep people entertained in a comedy, you have to have a certain amount of exaggeration. But, you know, the people I describe in the book are real people. I mean, the case histories I give, I've changed enough to preserve the confidentiality of the people involved so nobody could recognize them. But the actual situations, the situations that I've dealt with or that close colleagues have dealt with and told me about, I mean, these are real cases. These are not things that I just made up as examples, although, again, I had to change some of the details to protect privacy. And that's why I think people who have read the book have said, I can't believe it. That's my boss.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. That's the person who works for me. You know, how did you know? And the reason is because people are very variable between each other. I'm a different personality than you. You're a different personality than somebody else. But within our own selves, it's remarkable how consistent people are from moment to moment, from year to year, from decade to decade. In my business, one of the things that I learned is it's very difficult for people to make significant changes in themselves, even when they really, really, really want to. But most of the people you're going to meet in this world are perfectly happy with the way things are with themselves. They may think that the problem revolves around other people and that it's all everybody else's fault, and if everybody just kind of did what they want, things would be better. But most people don't want to change themselves. Most people want to change people around them or try to find some justification for why things aren't going their way.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in to your next category, which is the narcissistic and antisocial employees, which you characterize as preeners and predators.
You see, up until now, the personalities we've been discussing, although they can cause problems, they can cause tension, in a way, there's almost a pathetic aspect to them. I mean, the shrinkers and the clingers are kind of shy, independent, needy people. The histrionic and borderline are people who are just sort of prey to their emotions and have a hard time just establishing any kind of stability. But when you talk about somebody like the antisocial personality, this is someone who really is a predator. This is someone who, for all intents and purposes, does not have a conscience. And everything that they do is strictly for their own purposes. They will use people and spit them out without a second thought. Any kind of real loyalty, any kind of real allegiance is ephemeral, is non-existent. And probably the only thing you can do as an employer is do due diligence and not hire these people in the first place. If you get stuck with someone with an antisocial personality disorder, try to monitor their behavior as closely as possible and just wait for sooner or later something to happen that's going to be grounds for dismissal, and just make sure you document everything accordingly. The narcissistic personality disorder, in a way, in some ways, is a little more benign. This is the person who, as long as you agree with their overinflated view of themselves, they'll be your best friend. Some of them will be very loyal and faithful and friendly very good bosses, very good employees, as long as you feed their egos in the way that they feel it should be fed. The problem is if you fail to do that, if you fail to regard them as special, if you fail to recognize their unique capabilities, which of course will absolve them from the ordinary scut work that every other worker has to do, then things tend to turn. Then they start to get nasty. But again, even the most narcissistic personalities are not going to be ruthlessly predatory. If they're not getting the strokes they need, they'll just move on. Somebody once put it this way. They said that the antisocial personality believes that there should be no rules. Rules are for suckers. It's a dog eat dog world. Only the strong survive. They'll come out on the top of the pack because they're the meanest sons of you know what's in the valley. The narcissistic personality says, of course there should be rules. You can't run a society without rules. People should obey the rules, except for me.
Right. You know, some time back I had the privilege of interviewing, I think it's Robert Hare, who's done a lot of research on...
Well, he is a premier researcher in psychopathy, which is a variant of antisocial personality disorder.
Right, and he wrote a book called something like Snakes and White Collars. I'm probably mixing it up.
Snakes and Suits.
Okay, yeah, I'm mixing it up with Snakes on a Plane. But Snakes and Suits, so he seemed to suggest that there's a likelihood that your boss might be this antisocial type. What do you do if your boss is of the predatory type?
Keep your arms and legs inside the vehicle at all times and hang on for a wild ride. Because what you're going to do, you're going to be asked to bend the rules. You're going to be asked to cut corners. In a mild case, you're not going to necessarily be asked to do anything, frankly, illegal or unethical, but you'll be told to do some project, and then after you get it done, the antisocial personality boss will simply steal all the credit for it. Usually what happens is these individuals rise to sort of middle to upper middle levels of management, and then something happens and the whole thing comes crashing down. And it's like, you know, when you peel away a rotten tree limb and you see this festering ant colony underneath, you find that for years and years there's been this kind of dry rot that's been going on. You see this a lot, interestingly enough, in law enforcement agencies. As you know, I work with law enforcement departments, and occasionally, you know, news agencies love these stories about rogue cop, discovered. And what happens is you have somebody who was the police officer of the year, won awards for bravery, rescued children from burning buildings. I mean, all couldn't love this guy enough. And then you find out for the last 10 years he's been running this narcotic syndicate out of his police car. And every politician paid off and knows every drug dealer and so on. And so what tends to happen is these individuals usually trip themselves up because there are so many plots and so many intrigues that they can't keep them straight themselves. That's why Abraham Lincoln said, always tell the truth, that way you won't have so much to remember.
Yeah, I've been, all of these suggest movies and TV series. I've been watching The Shield lately, and they're rogue, very complex characters in that series. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I'm a big fan of The Shield.
Yeah,
people,
me too.
People have often asked me, is the lead actor, you know, the Vic Mackey character,
right,
is he a typical antisocial personality? And interestingly enough, the answer is probably no. And again, that brings up another interesting point is, although I present these personalities in the book, and although the DSM-4 presents them as distinct categories, everybody to some degree is a blend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like there are African American people, there are Asian people, and there are Caucasian people. But you know, everybody is kind of a blend of tones and colors and characteristics. You have very few people who are just one type of person or another.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vic Mackey character probably does have some antisocial characteristics in it. But the writers of the show are very careful to point out that every now and then there is a human side that sort of comes up. But you do get the sense that this is someone who is basically out for themselves, and although he seems to sincerely care about his family and his kids, basically is going to be out for himself. But you know, that would, in the first season, he probably would have been more of a classic antisocial personality. But I guess to keep the series going, they had to add some dimensions to his character in order to flesh it out.
Yeah, I find myself rooting for him. You know, as mean a character as he is at times. Still, they have done a good job of showing this other side to him. And in fact, that's often how it is in real life. When we get to know people, we discover that they're a complex mix.
Those people who study antisocial personalities, Robert Hare is one of them and some other researchers, what they point out is a lot of the qualities that go into making an antisocial personality, that sense of fearlessness, that sense of, you know, do or die, that sense of nothing will stand in my way, in some circumstances is actually an admirable quality. I mean, we want these traits in moderation to exist in soldiers, police officers, firefighters, those who have to really be brave and courageous,
mm-hmm.
and basically say, screw it, I'm going to go in there and take a chance and do something heroic, because these are the people we depend on. The problem is if it goes too far in the other direction, so that these people are now preying on the people that now depend on them, that's when we call it antisocial, as opposed to simply courageous and brave and fearless.
Yes. You go on to talk about obsessive, compulsive, and paranoid employees, who you call the detailers and the vigilantes. The vigilantes is such a kind way to refer to paranoids. I love it.
What I meant by vigilante really wasn't the sense of the guy who sort of stands at the border with a shotgun protecting his neighborhood. What I meant is someone who's being extremely vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing about a paranoid personality is they're on all the time. They go into a restaurant and they always sit with their back to the wall. The radar is always working. They're always looking for the angle. They tend to be very untrusting and cynical people. They pretty much assume that everybody is out for themselves and will screw you every chance you get. And the problem is they rely on a defense mechanism called projection. And the line I just gave you is pretty much the way they feel about other people. And so what happens is you have people who are sort of skeptical and mistrustful, and when you meet them, you get a creepy feeling like you're being evaluated or that they're, you know, running some kind of intelligence on you. And so naturally, you become a little standoffish, and the paranoid person then picks this up and says, see, that person doesn't really like me.
Mm-hmm.
And from experiences like this, we get the famous saying that just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
So as a manager, how would you deal with someone like that?
Be straight up. Don't be overly friendly, which is going to be only interpreted as a sign that you're trying to ingratiate yourself with the person. But don't be overly harsh. Be businesslike. Be authoritative. One thing that paranoid personalities tend to respect is legitimate authority. So don't be afraid to pull rank, but do so in a straightforward, consistent, and honorable way. And make it clear that, you know, you expect the rules to be followed, but as long as you're treated with respect and the people around you are treated with respect, you will treat that individual with respect. If you have a paranoid employer, it's kind of the reverse situation, and that is treat them with a certain amount of deference. If they ask for details, try to provide as many details as you can, but also set some boundaries and make it clear that there are certain intrusions into your personal life or certain lines of questioning that you're just not prepared to answer. And sometimes it may prove to be and sometimes your paranoid boss will respect that. Other times, if they get too intrusive, you may just have to leave the company. The obsessive-compulsive person is really a detail person. They're into details. They're into order. They're into control. And they actually make very good managers or sidekicks or secretaries or partners to other kinds of personalities, such as the narcissistic or histrionic personality, who are usually the ones with the brilliant, bright, creative ideas, but have no clue how to put them into action. So they partner up with an obsessive-compulsive person who can connect all the dots and actually get the project running. Now, the problem is an obsessive-compulsive boss is probably going to be a very demanding boss. The only good thing about it is at least his employees know that this boss is giving as good as he gets. That is, typically the obsessive-compulsive boss is not going to ask you to work any harder than he's willing to work himself. And so if he tells you instead of 9 to 5, you have to come in at 7:30 and leave at 6:30, he'll be in at 6 and he'll leave at 9.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is he'll expect everybody to keep that feverish type of pace.
Yeah.
And sometimes what you've got to do is document to him that by doing things in a more moderate way, your section or your department will actually be more productive, not less productive.
Okay.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to move on to the next one, which is you talk about schizoid and passive-aggressive employees who you dub as oddballs and spoilers.
Well, let's talk about the spoiler first. It's interesting because passive-aggressive personality is kind of controversial. It's not an official personality diagnosis in the DSM-4. However, it seems to be such a commonly encountered phenomenon that it was almost ridiculous not to include it. And basically, this is the person who seems to always get in their own way and get in other people's ways, but not in ways that are obvious. I mean, the term passive-aggressive means that they're doing something aggressive or harmful or sabotaging, yet doing it in a way that, on the face of it, can't be interpreted as being overtly aggressive. So if you give them a project to do, they'll turn in a beautiful project. It's better than an A+. The problem is it's turned in a day late. Or if you give them the same project to do another time, they'll come up with 250 types of excuses. It just seems to be that weekend their car broke down and their grandmother died and the dog had to go to the vet. And they're much like the borderline personality, who this may actually be kind of a cousin to. The passive-aggressive person always has stories about how if not for this, they would have been more successful, or if not for this person standing in their way, they would have been able to accomplish this or that. But, of course, it's really their own selves that are causing the trouble.
And what about the schizoid, who you characterize as an oddball?
Well, it's an oddball because most people, the typical reaction to someone with a schizoid personality is, what do you think of Joe? And, well, I don't know. I don't really know that much about him. He seems okay, but he doesn't really say much. I mean, he answers your question when you talk to him. And the interesting thing is the as we said before, the avoidant personality fears people. The dependent personality desperately needs people. And the schizoid personality basically could take people or leave them. And what they'll generally do is keep to themselves. They may have certain weird practices or weird ideas. And I think what a lot of clinicians believe is that the schizoid and schizotypal personalities are really, in a sense, mild forms of schizophrenia, which don't reach the full delusional loss of contact with reality that you see in the full-blown syndrome. But generally, I mean, schizoid personality, if you give them a job to do, they'll do it. They also tend to be very technically oriented most of the time. So these are going to be your classic computer geeks who could basically, work for a company for 5 years and no one's ever seen them except to go in and out of their cubicle. You know, they don't go to office parties, they don't really socialize, they sort of speak when spoken to, and pretty much if you can get them into a niche that they do well at, they'll be a very productive employee. The problem is if they suddenly wake up one day and decide they want to go climb Mount Everest, then they'll just send you a notice that they quit and disappear.
Okay. Now, sometimes people's problems, you note, have a neuropsychological or a mind-body basis. What can you tell us about handling those kinds of people?
Well, I put that in only because I think a lot of employers, and maybe this is from years and years of working in a workers' compensation clinic, where often we had to tease apart various types of disability syndromes ranging from something as overt as a broken leg or a slipped disc to something more sort of mysterious, such as a chronic pain syndrome or a post-concussion syndrome or an anxiety or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. And what I wanted to emphasize in those chapters is that although these are less common than the personality disorders in the first part of the book, occasionally you may see somebody who does have a psychosomatic disorder, who seems to take more than the usual amount of sick days that that another person takes, has all kinds of vague, mysterious complaints that never seem to have a pin-downable or definable medical basis. Or you may have somebody who has a brain behavior disorder. There are certain types of epilepsy, for example, whose manifestations aren't in the classical seizure sense, but may present with certain types of behavioral anomalies. Probably a very common brain behavior disorder is something called attention deficit disorder, which has become the subject of a number of books dealing with ADD in the workplace. But here's a person who has difficulty focusing, concentrating, staying on task, is very distractible, and is often mistaken for being lazy or even being on drugs. And again, the managers are not going to be clinicians. It's not a manager's job to diagnose and treat these syndromes, but simply to recognize that they exist, refer the employee for appropriate mental health follow-up when necessary, and learn how to deal with them productively in the job site. Because a lot of times they're not serious enough to quit the job or to be dismissed from the job. And in a few cases, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, certain of these disabilities actually have to be accommodated for at the workplace. And the more the people who make the decisions in the workplace understand these syndromes, the better they're going to do in accommodating them and making sure that the employee remains productive.
Now, one of the contemporary problems to confront the workplace are people going so-called postal violence in the workplace, which I think is maybe sort of a new phenomenon. I don't know how new it is or if it's increasing. It's certainly, I'm more aware of it than I used to be. And I know you've done a lot of work with law enforcement. What's your advice for dealing with individuals who might present a physical threat?
Well, probably in virtually no other area of catastrophe, let's say, is the situation preventable as in workplace violence. The first thing to realize is most violence at work is perpetrated by people who are not part of the workplace, things like robberies or other kinds of violent events. But the things that tend to scare people, the things that make the headline, is, you know, typically the story, here's a guy who worked for the company for a long time, seemed a little strange, but, you know, nobody could put their finger on it. Something happened and the guy snapped. Committed some kind of violent act, maybe shot a few people at work and so on. And then when you go back in the history, you see that it's been a long series of interlocking vicious cycle after vicious cycle, squabbles between that employee and the management, management's sometimes heavy-handed or clumsy handling of the situation, and things escalated to the point where the person sort of got fired or went home and brooded and decided to seek some kind of revenge, a kind of Rambo-esque type of escapade. Now, granted, there are thousands, if not millions, of people every day who are disgruntled at work. Very, very few of them become physically violent. So there has to be some element of severe personality disorder or psychopathology in the person who's committing the violence. But a lot of times this is not helped by the sort of clumsy and ham-handed way that some managers will treat dysfunctional employees. Again, this is not to excuse the violent reaction, but to show managers that there are ways of handling things appropriately. And that's what I try to do in that chapter on workplace violence, which is actually preceded by another chapter on more common types of workplace dysfunctions, because the two kind of go together. You know, if you have a worker who's a chronic complainer, if you have a worker who's a chronic underperformer, what I do in the book is I present a step-by-step, point-by-point protocol for dealing with these problems, from coaching and counseling to different types of disciplinary measures that you can use in a progressive way, to referring the employee for a fitness for duty evaluation, good ways of helping them access mental health services when necessary. And finally, if you have to fire an employee, there are still humane and good ways to do it as opposed to bad ways to do it, all of which will minimize the chance of an employee who has some kind of serious disturbance coming back and trying to blow the place up.
Well, I think that you have succeeded in writing a very practical book that deserves to be on every manager's bookshelf.
Well, I hope so. I think, you know, people work is hard enough when you do it the right way. I think if people can learn to understand each other from the bottom up and from the top down, then the process of work and the interpersonal aspect of work hopefully will get a little easier. And the payoff for everyone is that people become more productive. When it's more pleasant to go to work, you're bound to do a better job. And managers certainly and certainly executives should appreciate that.
Dr. Lawrence Miller, thanks so much for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a pleasure again, and I hope to speak with you again in the future.
I do hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Lawrence Miller. As you heard, this is the second time I've had him on, and I think he makes for a great guest. I find him very knowledgeable about a number of areas of psychology, and he speaks fluently and authoritatively. I'm happy to give his book a strong recommendation. Somehow he's managed to write it in such a way that I think it'll be useful to professional and lay audiences alike, as well as to boss and worker alike. Last night I lay awake for a while wondering where I might tie into this discussion in terms of this post-interview discussion. And I found myself remembering some truly nutty bosses that I worked for when I was quite young, before I went to graduate school. In fact, it was partly the experience of working for capricious, arbitrary bosses that drove me toward graduate school and a career where I could more or less be my own boss. And as I was in bed pondering these things, I realized that I don't particularly like the experience of being in a situation where other people have power over me. Of course, to some extent, that's unavoidable, what with governments, police forces, militaries, tax collectors, and so on, not to mention bosses. Being an employee really taps into trust issues, power issues, and issues with authority. And of course, that's a two-way street with implications for both employee and employer. As with relationships in general, a lot of how you deal with these issues probably derives from your early experiences with mom and dad or whoever raised you. And if you grew up in a warm, supportive, trustworthy environment, you probably won't have much trouble with bosses. If you had difficulties with your father, on the other hand, chances are that those may contaminate your relationship with bosses unless you've somehow managed to work those issues through. Transference and countertransference are as much in evidence in the workplace as in the therapeutic consulting room. When I got into market research, the guy I was working for, my boss, was 6 years younger than I am, but that didn't stop me from having all sorts of father figure transference on him. Even today, I look up to him. I don't work for him anymore, but even now I look up to him despite the fact that he's not only younger than I am, but also shorter than I am. And I fret that he sees me as an employee more than as a friend. And I know this stuff is from my own past, my father longing from a missing father. The professor-student relationship is much like the boss-employee relationship as well. There, too, transference can play a huge role. Some students fall in love or fall in hate with their teachers, projecting traits and attitudes that have little to do with the real person. Some students will think a professor has it in for them when, in fact, if it's a large class, the professor may only be dimly aware of their existence. And, of course, it can work the other way around, where the professor projects his or her own irrational or unmet needs onto one or more students. But, of course, I've never done that.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the bod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
All right.
Okay, now listen up. Nearly three-quarters of you who voted on our website said you'd be interested in a periodic live call-in episode of Shrink Wrap Radio, so we're going to give it a try. We'll be doing it on Sunday, December 9th at 10 in the morning Pacific Time. Now, that'll be 1 p.m. in the afternoon on the East Coast, and the rest of you will just have to calculate what time it will be wherever you are. You can listen to the show and participate in the web chat by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. Once again, www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. If you have a microphone hooked up to your computer, there should be a talk button on that webpage that will let you call into the show for free. Or you can dial in on a regular phone by calling 646-595-4286. Or if you have Skype, you can just Skype to that number, which is in New York. That number, once again, is 646-595-4286. Remember, mark your calendar for Sunday, December 9th at 10 a.m. Pacific. We'll also be doing a trial run on Sunday, December 2nd, which is just 2 days from now. All the same information will apply, but I'm not sure if you'll hear this podcast in time to make it to the December 2nd show. Remember, these are in addition to my regular Shrink Wrap Radio episodes, not instead of them. But the same information that I gave for the December 9th show will work for the December 2nd. The same URL and the same phone number, the same time on Sunday, December 2nd. So, hope to hear from you. Now, my good friend, Jerry Trumbull, who you heard on shows number 3, number 4, and number 100, will be co-hosting both of these with me, and we'll be sharing some psychology news items, and we'll take your calls and also respond to questions and comments on the Blog Talk chat stream. If you've just discovered this show recently, you should know that you can find the archives of the early shows on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. To keep the feed at a manageable size, with each new show, we drop an earlier show off the feed. So, for example, if you go to iTunes today, I think you will only find shows from number 48 on. However, you can find the first 47 shows on our website, and they're all good ones. There's a new interview up on my other podcast series, Wise Counsel. I interviewed Dr. Francine Shapiro, the originator of eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, otherwise known as EMDR, which you heard Dr. Tony Madrid speak of so highly on a recent Shrink Wrap Radio. I think it was number 119. So you'll find that interview with Francine Shapiro along with a free written transcript at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. And we finally have three new additions to our Frapper map. Dave from Ontario, Canada writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, as a psychology and metaphysical university student, I thank you." I didn't know you could study metaphysics in university, but whatever, that's great. And Anne from the Netherlands says, "I'm having sleepless nights over here because I can't stop listening." Hey, that's wonderful, Anne. Get some sleep, but do keep listening. And Adrian from the UK says, "Thanks for the podcast. Great show, Dr. Dave." Now, I'm proud of the Pod Show lineup of podcasts. They are a sponsor of ours, and they also have brought us GoDaddy as a sponsor. And you can subscribe to this show and other podcasts at podshow.com. And remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy to get a discount on the web domain name mybosshatesme.com or whatever web domain name suits your fancy.
Hi, this is Patricia Garfield from Tiburon, California at the IASD Dream Conference. And you're in a lucid dream with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Patricia Garfield, author of Creative Dreaming. Now let's catch up on some back email. First, we hear from longtime listener Susan, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I really enjoyed the email you received from Bruce in Leicestershire. As they interact and intersect, spirituality and psychology have cyclically alternated between mutual distrust and acceptance. Freud saw religion as somewhat of an illusion. William James believed it could foster psychological health. B.F. Skinner considered it to be yet another form of reinforced behavior. In the last few years, there have been inklings of rapprochement between the two disciplines, and now Nuk Sanchez and Tomas Vieira, in episode number 116, tell us that because we create our own ego-engendered reality, it's a dream, the outgrowth of our failure to realize we are one." That's a great summary, Susan. She goes on to write, "Because the boundaries between religion, philosophy, and psychology are so permeable, they'll likely continue to influence each other, so it can be useful and informative to listen to voices outside the mainstream. Your inviting, unobtrusive, and objective interviewing style brings us clear, informative pictures of your guests who come from a refreshingly broad and contemporary spectrum. All the best, Susan." Susan, I appreciate that vote of confidence, and it encourages me to keep on inviting some people who may be a little bit further out on the spectrum than I'm personally able to buy into. But for the reasons that you outline, I think it's a good idea, and so I'll keep doing it. Now, I received a couple of emails from Derek, who wrote to suggest that I get hold of Dr. Robert Altemeyer, who's done considerable research on the authoritarian personality. Derek sent me an email to that effect, which was also posted as a comment on show number 118, and you can read his comment there. And I've written to Derek, and I'll tell you all here that show is in the works. I've been in contact with Dr. Altemeyer. I'm very interested in the whole issue surrounding the authoritarian personality, and that will be coming up. Andrew in Wichita writes, "I just started listening and loved what I've heard so far. I'm a counseling student focusing on play therapy at Wichita State University, and I can see using your podcast as a way of sifting through things I'm already interested in researching. Thanks." He goes on to say, "I put up a review on iTunes, but wasn't able to copy the text out of iTunes, so I've attached a screenshot of my review. I don't know if you're still offering the books, but I'm sure you remember what it was like saving up for things to read as a student." Andrew. Well, Andrew, I do remember when my budget was considerably tighter than it is today, and I believe that I've already sent a book your way. I thank you very much for putting that review up on iTunes, as a number of you have done. Can't tell you how much it means to me. I've sent out a number of books, and I need to add a proviso to my offer to send books to listeners who put up a positive but genuine review on iTunes, which is, I've discovered it can be quite expensive for me to send books overseas. I hadn't anticipated quite how expensive it could be, and I have sent several out overseas, but I think I'm going to have to say that the free book offer is limited to U.S. listeners. I love my international listeners, too, but hey, there have to be limits. Now, Susan, whose email I read earlier, wrote a follow-up to a reply that I sent to her, and she wrote, "Thanks for writing. I just listened to your interview of Amy J.L. Baker on Wise Counsel and found your exchange so meaningful and enriching. My late parents had a troubled, sometimes violent marriage, and my mom was a real PASer," that's parents with alienation syndrome, "something I can easily understand in retrospect, especially with Amy's insight. I'm so grateful that towards the end of their lives, I was able to more fully understand both their perspectives. And even after their deaths, my brother and I have had many long, very healing conversations about the family's dysfunction, its roots, and its effects on our lives. I'm very much enjoying this phase of life. I'll soon be 56 and my husband 60. And the perspective afforded by all these decades, I have MS and some orthopedic problems, so I'm no longer working outside home. But what an opportunity for learning. I've never enjoyed myself so much. That's interesting that EMDR could be helpful for a mouse phobia. She had written jokingly that she had a mouse phobia, and I said, well, maybe you should try EMDR. So she goes on to say, do you think this modality holds more promise than desensitization? I've heard EMDR can yield dramatic results. Actually, I've exaggerated the mouse phobia a little. A few years ago, when some mice invaded our home, you can tell I still don't like them, my husband set traps and suggested I dispose of the dead mice. So with plastic gloves on and an enormous lawn and leaf bag, I faced the first defunct rodent and disposed of him. I felt a little queasy, but was able to do it again later. After once having seen a TV show on rats and hantavirus, I didn't want to touch them barehanded. How's that for progress, though? But I wonder if EMDR would work for mother-in-law phobia. Well, Susan, thank you again for writing and for your comments on the Amy Baker Show on Wise Counsel. I heard from a couple of people that interview was particularly meaningful for them. And also people have responded very positively and strongly to the EMDR interview with Tony Madrid. And now there is one on Wise Counsel, I think I mentioned earlier, with the founder of that approach, Dr. Francine Shapiro. Pressing on, longtime listener and now fellow podcaster Lloyd in Australia writes, hi, Dave. As a libertarian, I found number 118, Psychology of Materialism, to be a little scary. I'm all for redefinition of success and the reduction of materialism. And under a capitalist democracy, we're all free to pursue those goals. There's a clear distinction between capitalism and materialism. One does not necessarily follow the other. Basically, I don't need or want the government telling me how I should be happy. That's up to me to work out for myself. Lloyd, thanks as always for writing and expressing your strong and independent viewpoint. Jesse in Florida writes, I left a review for you on iTunes. I love your show and listen regularly. And he lets me know that his review was titled Chillin' on the Couch with Dr. Dave, in which he wrote, I'm a fourth-year psychology student at UCF, and I wish my classes taught me some of the interesting topics that Dr. Dave brings to us on his shows. His questions are deep and interesting, and his guests are top-notch. A word of warning, the show will expand your horizons with what psychology entails. Well, that was his review. Actually, he's in Ireland, and he goes on to write, although the offer of a book is unnecessary, your show is great on its own. I very much appreciate it and can't wait to read it. I've gone and purchased Choice Theory Reality Therapy and 8 Lessons from Glasser, so I must admit this feels awkward, almost like mooching. Please don't send those as I have them already. Thank you very much. It's finals time here at UCF, and I've been incredibly busy, but I will record you a transition after everything calms down. I'll also get around to sending you a longer letter, as I have a few questions and ideas that I would love to run by you. Thank you, and keep up the show as long as you enjoy making it. Jesse. Jesse, thanks very much for that offer of a transition. I'll look forward to getting it, and I did send off a book to you. Next, Nicole writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for about a year now and really enjoy your podcasts. I also really like your website. I'm looking to set up my own podcast and website, but I'm having trouble finding a host that supports podcasts, blogs, and comments that require people to leave their name. I've looked at GoDaddy, and they look good. What's been your experience with them? There were a couple of things that worried me. One was their intellectual property clause in their contract, and another was that many sites such as Hum Domains offer exactly the same blogcast deal. I know you mentioned GoDaddy quite often. Have you had any problems with them? Kind regards, Nikki. I'm not using GoDaddy for the hosting of this particular show, but I have bought a number of domains through GoDaddy. I have no complaints or fears about GoDaddy. For your podcasting, I recommend Libsyn, LIBSYN.com, to anybody considering putting up their own podcast for $5 a month. Libsyn does a wonderful job. I would also recommend Podshow, my sponsor. The trade-off is they'll do it for free, but they will insert ads, as you've heard at the beginning of my show. And I'll wrap it up with one more email from longtime listener Cody in Israel, who wrote, "Hi, David, thank you for endorsing my little book," which I did on the last show. She says, "I like your great new show. I found your maternal infant bonds show very interesting. And at the same time, I found the fact very strange that it was coincidentally aired together with your other show on Wise Counsel titled Parental Alienation Syndrome. Both of your shows talked about parent-child relationship. Anyway, I wish you and your family a happy Thanksgiving." Thank you, Cody. And the similarity in themes was purely coincidental or synchronistic or fated, depending upon how you want to look at it. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Don't forget you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. Don't forget you can leave me a voicemail on Skype. Actually, that feature had expired and I had to send them some more money, but it's active again now. So you can just leave a message there for ShrinkPod, or you can leave voice messages using the My Chingo button on the site. And we also have a voicemail number in the U.S., which is 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Lawrence Miller for his insights and advice on dealing with psychopathology in the workplace. On my next show, we'll take a guided tour of the Exploratorium, a world-class science museum in San Francisco with an exhibit area called The Mind. And our tour guide will be their staff neuropsychologist. I think you'll find it interesting. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.